And now to slimy politics. No, we're not talking necessarily what's going on in the US, and we're not making any suggestions that Australia's getting slimy in its politics with today's raid on the office of Stephen Conroy. Strange timing, though, isn't it, for an election campaign? What we're talking about is slime mould. And to set this up, I want you to listen to a trailer for Steve McQueen's first movie. It's called The Blob, and it takes us back to 1958.
Well, what was it? Stop with it, kid.
Well, it's kind of like a... It's kind of like a mass that keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Two teenagers see it first, like a falling star from outer space.
Boy, that was close. Hey, come on, I want to see if I can find it.
An old man finds it, touches it, and this is the shocking result. From then on, there's no stopping the blob as it spreads from town to town. It's indestructible. It's indescribable. Nothing can stop it.
And it may, in fact, be the answer to all our democratic problems. Slime doesn't have to be scary. Jean-Paul Gagnon is assistant professor in politics at the University of Canberra's School of Government. And in late 2015, he published an intriguing paper called A Lesson in Democracy from Slime Molds. He followed that up with a three-part essay in the online journal The Conversation about non-human democracy. In other words, how animals and even vegetation make decisions about how to survive. Now, we've looked at the way apes, chimpanzees and other species play and interact, and most of us as humans can relate to that. But how do we see ourselves or gain insight from single-cell amoeba? Jean-Paul is in our Canberra studio. Welcome to our Little Wireless program.
Thank you very much for having me, Philip.
John, you're not a biologist, but I'd like you to give us a brief biography of the slime mold.
Sure. Now, that's always a slightly dangerous question to ask an academic. How much would you like to know?
Just enough to keep the momentum of our little program going.
Very well. Slime molds are ancient life forms. Now, they're estimated to have been around for a billion years. Now, that's amazing. Comparatively, we humans and humanoids really only started appearing in the record some 7 or 8 million years ago.
So in the cosmic calendar, where a year is the Big Bang to now, we've been around for 1 second.
Effectively. You know, we are very young compared to slime molds. And another fascinating thing about them is that they show both animal-like and plant-like characteristics, which make it difficult for us, I suppose, to try to classify them. And early scientists, indeed, had a really hard time trying to figure out what exactly they were. So it was a bit of that, I'd say a less scary version of the Steve McQueen experience. Slime molds are capable of achieving great transformations. And here's an example, a brief one, of the cellular slime mold, Dictostelium discoides. Now, a dictostelid slime mold, we'll call him Frank, starts off as a dormant spore in, say, a small bit of soil. Frank wakes up when he detects food. He mainly eats bacteria. Once he captures a bacterium to eat, he'll start reproducing by splitting himself in half. That's called mitosis. He'll do this in his copies.
I've always thought it's a much better way of getting organizing things. Sex becomes so complex, fraught and dangerous.
And indeed, they often do get up to a bit of meiosis, or sex between single-celled organisms, to the point where there are thousands of Franks around. And now we've got this society that lives in this tiny bit of soil. Now, their main problem is when the food runs out. It only takes one individual to start releasing a chemical signal called a crasin, and that triggers the next phase in Frank's life.
Now, you were criticized by some people for calling this mold Frank, but you point out it could just as well have been Francine.
Yes. And I think the issue with the, and I suppose it was the only issue that emerged with this paper that I published, blog really, was that I used an alliterative device. So I called it the mycelium of men. And the mycelium is this type of network that Franks form. And they do this to come together when the food runs out. So when the acrescens out there, they start coming together, streaming and forming this branch-like pattern to form an amazing thing. They form this slug-like creature.
Now, the surprising thing is that using a brainless single-cell organism as a metaphor the way you do, we're very used to animal kingdom metaphors in public discourse, but it holds up, doesn't it?
Well, I think so. And the fact of the matter is that we've used quite often in the way that we've looked at democracy mechanistic metaphors. So we've often spoken about it in terms of being a machine or an engineered product that we humans have made. And looking at it as Lawrence Whitehead, so an Oxford fellow in politics, does, he argues that we can rejuvenate the way that we understand our democracies and the problems they have by thinking of them in biological terms, so as living systems. And that's exactly what allows us to try to draw these comparisons between other species and the type of things we create.
Like Sean Paul, we've talked with Tim Flannery in the past about termite mounds as a great place to learn. The beehive, of course, is often cited, but I understand that you're not alone in being fascinated by slime mold, that computer scientists and engineers are equally intrigued. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because the slime molds have remarkable capacities, and it's these capacities that shot them to pop star status. So researchers, for instance, argue that slime molds have a type of memory. They remember where they've already been when searching for food.
You mean they have some sort of collective or individual intellect that allows them to learn?
Well, it's really quite difficult, I think, to pin this down, because again, we're trying to make sense of what they do, the behaviors they exhibit in a lab, from our own perspective. So although I don't think we're anthropomorphizing them, right, we're not projecting ourselves onto slime molds, there is evidence to show that, you know, in a maze, for instance, when a slime mold is searching for a bit of food in a maze, once they've cleared out an area, they'll effectively remember they've been there, and they won't go down that path and try another avenue. But they're also great at solving road planning problems.
I'm sorry, solving what sort of problems?
Traffic planning or congestion problems.
Right.
And they do this because they usually work out the most efficient route to food in a maze. And some scientists, like in Japan, have been using this to try to figure out how to plan for the traffic of the future. And it might be a great way of trying to solve Sydney's road congestion.
Don't rush ahead. I mean, I just want to dwell and luxuriate in the slime for a while. Social media and the internet may be seen as comparable to the network created by the slime mold.
Yeah, so we humans do create our own type of networks. I mean, flight patterns are one of them, or Twitter networks. But the difference, I think, between slime molds and us, and this is something that scholars like Cass Sunstein raises, or the University of Melbourne's Robin Eckersley, we tend to form associations based around specific issues. So we tend to gravitate to people who are publishing opinions that we agree with or that reinforce our own beliefs. And that can be a good thing, and that can be really great. I mean, forming associations is one way for us to tackle very specific problems. It's what public policy scholars call a policy community. But slime molds, they depend on each other for survival. If they don't all, in effect, work together, if they don't form a consensus, so to speak, on when to go from being individuals looking for bacteria to joining up and forming this slug to get out of starvation, then they risk death. Now, of course, we don't face the same situation. Elections for us aren't often matters of life and death, so we can only extend the metaphor so far. And what I
What colour are slime molds? Are we talking about things that can be as pretty as coral polyps? And if so, are they being bleached by climate change?
That's a great question. Now, slime molds are really diverse, and some of them can actually form big unicellular blobs, effectively. So you might go out into the woods and find a more common variant, which is, I think, less affectionately known as the dog vomit slime mold, that looks like a big pile of yellow goo. But others form very beautiful and delicate red stalks and fruiting bodies, or type of translucent blues and greens. They're really
I think I've beautiful. Seen them at the farm, and a lot of people think they're fungi, a kind of mushroom, because of the way they spread on dead branches.
Yes, and that's effectively what stumped a lot of the earliest scholars in this area. So the German botanist Oskar Breffeld was the first person to isolate and describe a species of cellular slime mold. But it took, and by the way, he found that in not a very charming place. It was in horse dung that he was examining. But it did kick off more than 100 years of research into them, because they're mysterious, sometimes alien-looking even. And they did resist biological classification. Are they animals, right? They form a slug shape? Or are they plants, because they can become fungus, mushroom-looking affairs? And that's why they're now classified as protists, which, as Chris...
Would you spell that for me?
Oh, that's P-R-O-T-I-S-T-S.
It sounds a bit like POTUS, President of the United States.
Well, we might actually have a category for the President of the United States, because...
Well, the slime mold seems to be about to take over in that particular political... But perhaps not as likable as the slime molds you're describing.
Well, you know, they're obviously not not human, and as we come to them from a position of, you know, humility and intellectual curiosity, they never cease to impress. They're really fascinating forms of life.
When did you first come across them, John Paul? How did you become a slime mold aficionado?
Well, I'd like to say that, I happened upon them in some magical wood in Europe or something, but it was a bit more mundane. I became especially interested in them after writing that essay that you introduced, which was published by The Conversation over Christmas in 2015, and is called Non-Human Democracy. Now, I saw researchers in other fields, like engineering, who look to non-humans for clues, right, on how to solve problems that we humans are experiencing. And slime molds pop up in that literature. So I gave traffic congestion as one example. So scientists are trying to use them to help figure out ways of, well, planning the roads and highways and stuff of the future in big cities. And so we have this opportunity of working together. Now, I wondered, why aren't we doing the same thing with our democracies? So I'm a democratic theorist, and on a daily occasion, I run into the problems that democracies like Australia's have. And I thought, gosh, maybe the slime mold can actually bring something to light for us.
We're discussing slime, the slime mold, and how it can save the world with Jean-Paul Lignon, and... By strange coincidence, I got an email from someone whose name I'm sure you will know, Jean-Paul, and that's Fred Cheney, one of the great liberals when the Liberal Party was still liberal. And he wrote thus, "I am finding the campaign on both sides dispiriting. We seem to be locked into the political game, an endless round of political payback and personal desperation." So he, like me, is reaching out to you and the slime mold. How can they help us decide who to vote for?
Well, I think at the moment anyway that slime molds have more to say about us outside of Parliament than those occupying the seats within it. And that's inspiring. And I say this because slime molds make their decisions to survive. They must, so to speak, form consensus, for divided, they will fall. Now, as I've said, we're not slime molds. Elections don't mean life and death for us. But elections aren't the great coming together and festival of politics that a number of people have made them out to be. Well, not in today's political culture. Anyway, in my eyes, elections in countries like Australia or the United States show us how divided we are. Forming a majority government on, say, a 53-47 for against split isn't a great decision that voters are making. They're saying that we are split and aren't in agreement on how our society should proceed.
And as sure as hell, the slime mold is not divided.
No, because that, of course, puts them at risk of starvation and all these terrible things. You can extend that metaphor, though, to work that people like Francis Fukuyama in the United States from Stanford University is doing. Now, in his recent works, he's reminding us about how institutions, so political institutions or social institutions and economic institutions, I mean, tax reform seems to be a very big topic in these early stages of our election here. But he says that they can actually empty themselves of democratic content. Now, how do we, the people of a democracy, literally the sovereigns of the democracy, know when that's happening? How can we communicate to one another when the health of our democracy might be at risk? If it's sick, if it needs medicine, and how we might go about helping to cure it and make it stronger and more resilient for the future.
I mentioned termite mounds previously, and a passing reference to the beehive. If we could put slime mold to one side, one of the animals that was discussed in the ancient world, by I think Aristotle, was the bee. What might we learn from the bee?
Well, the bees are fantastic. They are amazing. And their story, I will be brief, is very inspiring. Now, when a hive gets packed, so one hive has been very successful. They've collected lots of honey. They've reproduced a lot, and they're full. Max capacity, no vacancy, right? They start to get sleepy. So the worker bees, the scouts, and so on. And they start to not move around. And so what happens is this remarkable thing of older scout bees in the society, and that's usually about 3-5% of them, they start to run through their sisters. You know, they buzz their wings, they shake their bodies, they energize them. And what they do is they get this great mass coming out of the hive, and they cluster somewhere nearby. And when they cluster, it's the job now to find their new home. And so you'll have 3-5% out of maybe something as big as 30,000 bees flying in all compass directions, looking for the perfect home. They search high and low. They prefer trees. They have an idea of how big the cavity should be if they find a hollow in a tree. And each individual bee will actually walk around and measure, in this sense, the volume of the cavity. Now, if they find a home that meets, it's the Goldilocks effect that's just right for them, that bee will fly back to the cluster and start doing its famous waggle dance. And people like Thomas Seeley from Cornell University, who's an old hand with honeybee research, can almost tell you exactly where that bee is pointing to when it does its waggle dance, because it does it relative to the sun. And if it's really excited, if it's really doing a great, vigorous dance, it attracts more interest from its sisters. Here's the further remarkable thing. Those sisters fly off, they go to the nest, they measure it themselves, and then they come back, and if the site is as good as promised, they'll follow it.
We're out of time, which is a shame because I was getting more and more wildly excited, but I know Bill Shorten is listening, so Bill, change the name from the ALP to the ALB, and we're in with a chance. Jean-Paul, you're a remarkable guest. Jean-Paul Gagnon, Associate Professor of Politics at the University of Canberra. And coming up next, we're going to have a brief history of seven killings. all took place in Jamaica. In 1976, here's a bit of Bob Marley.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.